Tommy B wasn't taking any chances this time. He hated having to do it because it was like admitting to a weakness that he didn't trust himself to figure out how to do this job on his own. But he knew that Polly wouldn't see it that way. When it came to anything outside running the complicated business aspects of the family, little Polly was like a part of the furniture, and he'd be thrilled to be consulted on something like this. It would make him feel important, and that was just how Polly had reacted. The day after Tommy came to him for help, stressing how very confidential it was, that it was a job the old man himself had wanted done, and they should not under any circumstances discuss it with anyone, Polly called him and said,
I've got that information you wanted.
Tommy didn't waste any time getting down to Polly's quarters on the first floor in the west wing of the mansion. Although they lived separated only by two floors, Tommy hadn't been down to Polly's rooms since they were kids. Even then, he thought Polly had been a wimp, more interested in reading and playing with his computers than in the games that he and Rick had played with the other kids in the Enclave. The three brothers were as different as brothers could possibly be, except for a physical resemblance that was much stronger between Tommy and Rick than between them and Polly. They were very much their father's sons, while Polly took more after their mother. All through their early childhood, little Polly had been Tommy's whipping boy, yet curiously, like a slavish dog that comes to lick its master's hand after it's been beaten, Polly had never held it against him. There had always been a sort of sibling rivalry between Polly's other older brothers, but it was more on the side of Tommy than of Rick. Tommy was the oldest one, expected to be stronger and better at their games, but it was Rick who usually came out on top, seemingly without much effort, and without any visible emotion either. Rick was physically stronger, he was more athletic, he was quicker, and he always beat Tommy in any competition, though he was never smug about it, and it never seemed to make much of a difference to him that he had won. And it was that very nonchalance that drove Tommy crazy, and usually he took it out on Polly. Rick had never abused their little brother, but he had never paid any attention to him either, and though Polly suffered from the torments that Tommy inflicted on him, it was almost as if he preferred that to being ignored, as Rick ignored him. And almost everybody else, for that matter. Polly was a wimp, thought Tommy, but Rick was just plain spooky. Polly's room had not been changed much since he was a kid. If anything, it had become even more of a spilling cornucopia of books and tapes, computer terminals, and various electronic gizmos. It looked like the inside of a space station, which was appropriate, Tommy thought, because Polly was a real space cadet. He sat there in his room like some kind of mole, the old man's pet accountant, taking care of business and keeping tabs on various complex transactions, not caring one way or another about what they were concerned with. To him, it was just a symphony of numbers and data. And when he wasn't doing that, he played with his computers, devising esoteric programs, or entertaining himself with books from his voluminous collection of classic science fiction, most of it written years ago, before the bio war. Authors like Harlan Ellison and Norman Spinrad, William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, Orson Card, J.G. Ballard, and Edward Bryant, all the people who Tommy never heard of. Once a month, Polly would scuttle out from the confines of his room like some silverfish and have one of the men drive him down into the city, where he'd spend hours going from one used bookstore to another. He'd come back with a truckload of the stuff that he kept piling up on the shelves until there was no more room for any more, and they'd start spilling over onto the tables into boxes and piles on the floor. It got so you could barely move in there. Tommy had tried looking at some of the stuff once, but he couldn't make head nor tail of it. Damn stuff made no sense, but Polly treasured every single tattered dog-eared copy. He was sitting at one of his computers as Tommy came into his room, which had all the curtains drawn as usual. There was hardly any light except for Polly's desk lamp and the glow from the screens of half a dozen or more computer terminals. He sat there at his desk, as pale and ethereal as a ghost, looking almost like a girl with his soft, pretty features and his long dark hair falling to his slender shoulders. The old man usually disapproved of that from time to time, and from time to time, he'd snap at one or another of the men to get a fucking haircut, but this disapproval did not seem to extend to Polly. Little Polly could always get away with everything, but then little Polly never really did anything that he had to get away with, and he kept the family business running smoothly. "What you got for me, Polly?" Tommy said as he came into the darkened room. Take a look at this," said Polly. He punched up a full-color graphic display on the computer. It was a model of a building. "What the hell is that?" said Tommy. "I come to you for a plan, and you show me a picture of some fucking building?" It's not just any building," Polly said. He punched a couple of buttons on the keyboard, and a cross-section of the building appeared. "It's a plan of the building where Steele lives. He's got the penthouse floor." "Yeah, how the hell did you get a hold of that?" "City Housing and Planning Commission," Polly said. "I just pulled it from their databank." "No kidding. That's good, Polly. That's good." Polly beamed at the praise. "Look here," he said. Little red lights lit up all over sections of the building. "This is where they've got their security systems, and they've recently made some new additions. Those things up there on the penthouse roof are automated anti-aircraft gun turrets, controlled from the central building city station inside the building. That's this blue area over here. These yellow lights represent video cameras. They've got the whole building pretty well covered, and they've got a radar, too. That's the orange up there. Short of taking up the entire building with a guided missile or something, there's just about no way to hit the place. At least, none that I can see. So why can't we use some kind of missile, like you said? Because you'd kill a lot of other people, Tommy. So what? So there's a lot of federal personnel living in this building, Polly explained patiently. Legislators, congressional aides, bureaucratic employees. So some of them are on our payroll, Polly said. There are people, and Papa's gone to a lot of trouble over the years to set up those connections. That's how we were able to hijack the weapons shipments. One of them tipped us off and got us all the information, and we've got other deals working through some of them. They're valuable. Can't any of them get us in? Polly shook his head. They'd blow their cover. Security's too tight in there. And even if you did get in, there's no way you'd get back out again. Yeah, all right, said Tommy Riley. So what you're telling me is that all this shit comes to nothing but a big fat zero, right? So what is the plan, Polly? I'm getting to that, said Polly. Look here. He punched a few more buttons on the keyboard. What's that? It's a subway terminal underneath the building, Polly said. There's a small shuttle train that runs directly from the federal building, strictly for the VIPs. Keeps them from having to brave the streets at night when they're having late sessions in Congress. And sometimes they just cut out and go back home to catch a few winks or have some dinner, spend some time with the family or whatever, till they get called back for a roll call vote. So they need a shuttle back and forth quite often. So what does that have to do with anything? Asked Tommy, getting irritated. Fucking Polly was wasting his time. I'll show you, Polly said. The picture scrolled across the screen, following the shuttle tunnel back towards the federal building, still in cross-section, showing the tunnel and the buildings on the streets above it. Tommy had to give it to him. Polly had gone through a lot of trouble to put all this together, but he still didn't see what any of it had to do with taking care of steel. Then Polly stopped it. Look here, he said, pointing at the screen. What's that? It's another subway tunnel, Polly said. One of the old tunnels from before the war that they're not using anymore. There's no lines running through it. They've got it sealed off where the shuttle tunnel cuts through it. But I've checked on it. And all they've got it sealed off with is heavy steel gates. You can get through those without a lot of trouble. What for? So you can run something out onto the tracks and block up the tunnel, Polly said. Why the hell would I want to do that? Polly gave him a patient look. To stop the shuttle halfway down the tunnel, he said. Why? Hostages, Tommy. You can't get into Steele's building. You can't hit his penthouse from the outside with choppers. You try to catch him going in or out like you did before, and unless you can manage to drop him right away, he's out in the open where he can maneuver, and he's got all the security inside the building for backup. And they'll be ready for something like that now. They'll probably have people posted on the rooftops all around the building and across the street, but if you can take out a bunch of congressmen as hostages, then you can get Steele to come to you on ground that you can choose. You can have him exactly where you want him. You get him to come out on the island on roads where you can check to make sure he's not being followed by any backup units. Hey, Polly, that's not too bad, said Tommy. That's not bad at all. Only, how do we know when to hit the shuttle? Easy, Polly said, basking in his older brother's praise. We have one of our people in the federal building tip us off. Somebody dependable. Somebody who's got an awful lot to lose if he screws up. I've already got the man in mind. Sanderson, the representative from New Jersey. He's the one who tipped us on the ordnance job, and he's got family we can get to. But that probably won't be necessary. He's a Wheeler dealer, sharp and very cool. Not the type to lose his nerve in a pinch, and he's into us real deep. We wait until Congress is having one of its late sessions and legislators have to be called back for a vote. We have Sanderson tip us off and make sure that he'll be on that shuttle. Yeah, okay, said Tommy, impressed. Only what happens if we snatch some of the people on our payroll? That's part of the plan, said Polly. We need them later, but we won't tip them off in advance just to play it safe. That way we can make sure nobody loses their nerve at the last minute and misses the shuttle. Sanderson will be the only one who'll know what's going down. He's a take-charge kind of guy. He can make sure everybody stays calm. Tell them not to do anything stupid. Just do what they're told. Cooperate with the kidnappers and try not to do any heroics. We simply make sure nothing happens to any of our people. We segregate them from the others after we've made the snatch and stash them somewhere comfortable, on the theory that you don't want to keep all your hostages in one place in case the feds should try anything. Then we can let them know what's going down. Yeah, said Tommy, nodding. Polly had really thought this out. Yeah, okay, all right. It's a good plan, Polly. It's a real good plan. That's only part of it, said Polly, smiling, thrilled that Tommy approved. Wait till you hear the rest. I've got the whole thing figured out, down to the last detail. Okay, so give, said Tommy, anxious to hear it all. Well, the first thing we have to do is make sure certain that none of this gets back to us, said Polly. Papa won't like it if it gets out that the family's kidnapped a bunch of congressmen. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, said Tommy, remembering what the old man had said to him. How do we get around that? After you've taken care of Steele, you kill the hostages, except for Sanderson and the others we control, of course, and they'll be the only ones left to identify any of the kidnappers. When it's all over, they'll look through the files with the cops, and the only people they'll pick out as ones who were part of the gang will be Delano people. We can show them a few photographs and brief them so they'll know the right ones to pick out. The whole thing will be a setup to make it look like the Delanos pulled it. Tommy was impressed, real impressed. He didn't think that Polly had it in him to be this cold. With a possible flaw in the plan occurred to him. But if we have to whack all the others, he said, how do we account for the ones who get out of it alive? What are they supposed to do? Escape? No, said Polly, leaning back in his chair and smiling. We rescue them. We rescue them? Sure, said Polly. The hostages will be split up into two groups, remember? One of the groups will be the legislators on our payroll. The other group will be ones we can kill. When news of the kidnapping gets out, we call the media and make a big ransom demand. In the name of the Delanos, of course. Then we call Steele and tell him that if he wants to see the hostages released alive, he'll do exactly as we tell him. He'll know that it's a trap, but he won't have any choice. If we get accused of engineering the snatch, we issue a statement on behalf of Papa denying it, claiming it's a frame, and promising that to prove it, the family will do everything in its power to assist the authorities in obtaining the return of the hostages. Then, after you've taken care of Steele, we send out some people to hit one of the Delano warehouses down on the South Shore. Hit it hard, blow it up, and make a lot of noise. Then we have Rick deliver Sanderson and the others to the police. We use Rick because he's immediate family, and he's got no warrants on him, so he can still go out to the city. We alert the media, make sure they're on hand to get footage of Rick and some of our people bringing in the hostages, and Sanderson and the others will tell them that they were being held in the Delano warehouse that we hit, and Rick and his people rescued them. Rick will say that we got a tip where the hostages were being held, but the Delanos killed off the others before we get to them, and the Delanos will get the blame for whacking Steele as well. They'll scream like crazy and deny it, but no one will believe them, and the family will come out of the whole thing looking like the good guys, smelling like a rose. Tommy stared at his little brother with amazement. Jesus Christ, Polly! That's incredible! You're a fucking genius! Thanks, Tommy, Polly said, looking down at the floor, shyly. You did good, Polly. You did real good. I can't see where the plan could fail. I worked on it real hard, Tommy. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I like it. Only look, there's a lot at stake here, you understand what I'm saying? If for some reason anything should go wrong, not that I think it will, I just want to make sure that none of it comes down on you. I mean, if anybody screws up, you know, it won't be your fault, but whoever thought up the plan will probably get the blame, and the old man will hit the ceiling. I really appreciate all the help you've given me on this, and I want to show my appreciation, so I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take the heat, okay? I'll say that we came up with the plan, and that you just helped me work out some of the details. That way, just in case anything doesn't play out the way you should, it'll come down on me. You don't have to do that, Tommy, Polly said, looking concerned. I wouldn't want you to get in any trouble, not on account of me. Hey, we're brothers, right? Brothers are supposed to take care of each other. Besides, I can handle it. The old man won't be too hard on me. But you, this sort of thing isn't normally your business. Know what I'm saying? The old man would think you had no call to get involved in putting this together, something like this, especially when you've had no experience. I'll just say that the whole thing was my idea in the first place. That way you'll be covered, just in case. You do that for me? Polly said, wide-eyed. Jeez, Tommy. Thanks. I really appreciate it. I don't know what to say. No sweat, kid. But look, if it makes you feel any better, you can figure that you owe me one, okay? Yeah, sure thing, Tommy. Anything you say. You name it. It's real swell of you to do this. Hey, it's just my way of showing my gratitude, said Tommy magnanimously. Come on. What do you say we have a drink? Oliver Higgins sat back in his office chair, smoking his pipe and listening to the tape-recorded conversation that took place between Dev Cooper and Philip Gates in Cooper's apartment on Sutton Place. None of them suspected that he had both their homes bugged, as well as their phone lines, just as he had bugged everyone else who worked on the project, including Steele. Higgins suspected that Steele knew that they could tap into his electronic brain using the broadcast interface, but lately he had resisted doing so. There hadn't been any real reason to. So far, Steele was performing up to expectations and doing the job he'd been sent out to do. Higgins didn't much mind. Or care how he went about it, as long as he got it done. And he couldn't complain about the publicity that Steele was generating. For the first time, His superiors were starting to look with favor on the project, and there was talk of additional funds forthcoming that would enable them to undertake the next step in the plan. Things were going very well, but this new development with Gates and Cooper, Higgins wasn't quite sure what to think about that. He had known for some time that Gates was sneaking classified material home with him, and he had done nothing to stop him, though he had watched him carefully. Gates was not the type to market classified material. He had no real ambition. Technically, he had compromised project security, but to date, no harm had come of it. He had simply taken some small pieces of equipment and some programs so that he could work with him at home. And with the security in his building, there was no chance of his place being burglarized. Gates was always careful, if a bit lax about security procedures, and it was no great problem to keep tabs on him. But Dev Cooper? That was another story. Cooper was a bit too independent for Higgins' tastes. And now he had just proven that he wasn't trustworthy. Not that trust was a commodity that Higgins ever dealt with. He did not believe in trust. He believed in information. Information was power. Information was control. Information was security. And if Higgins had his way to safeguard the security of the government, he would have placed a bug in every bedroom in the country. Cooper was, in effect, blackmailing Gates into withholding information. Information that could prove vital to the success or failure of the project. If Steele's personality was, indeed, in the process of fragmenting, he'd have to be pulled in and debugged before it became serious. No question about that. But Steele seemed to be okay, and Higgins was fascinated with what the two of them were doing. It had some extremely interesting implications. "What do you want me to do about this?" asked Connors, the agency chief of project security. "You want me to bring them both in?" "No," said Higgins thoughtfully. "Not just yet. Let's see what they do. I want you to keep close tabs on both of them, maintain surveillance around the clock, and keep me posted on anything Gates takes out of the labs. Any data he pulls from the project files. Keep an especially close eye on Cooper, but make sure he doesn't know he's being kept under surveillance. He's sharp, so tell your people not to be sloppy. I want to see where he goes with this."
"Whatever you say," said Connors.
"What have you got for me on this girl, Raven?" Connors consulted his notes.
"Her real name's Ravenna Scarpetti," he said. "She's a hooker. Folks dead, no living relatives. She apparently came out of the Borodini enclave out on the island. Tommy B. took a personal interest in her when she was about 15 or so. Tommy likes them young. He used to squire her around Midtown, take her to all the fancy joints he used to hang around in to rub soldiers with the in crowd. Word is they had a lover's quarrel when she caught Tommy in the sack with one of her friends. She cut him and gave him a scar on his face. He apparently worked her over real good, then sold her to a pimp in no man's land, a psychopath named Rico, who's a part of the prostitution operation the Borodinis run. She's been with Rico ever since. She's had several arrests for assault and battery and assault with a deadly weapon, but the charges were all dropped."
"Interesting," said Higgins, nodding. "So it all fits. Steele's using her as a source of information about the Borodini enclave. And undoubtedly for other things besides," he added with a smile.
"You want me to bring her in for questioning?"
"No, leave her alone. Just keep an eye on her. What about Ice?"
"He's another story," Connor said. "We've been trying to put something together on him ever since he came to us, but it's really hopeless. He was born in no man's land, so like most people out there, there isn't any record on him. Officially, he doesn't exist. And all we really know about him is that he's big and black and could probably eat his desk if he felt like it. We don't know his real name. We don't know how old he is. Prior to his coming to prominence as leader of the Skulls, there's absolutely nothing known about him. And with what we've heard, we can't separate fact from rumor. He's been playing ball so far. When he isn't out with Steele, he keeps to himself in his room, except for that one time he went out to take a girl shopping for some clothes."
"What does he do in there?" asked Higgins.
"Sleeps. Watches television. Reads."
"Reads? That Neanderthal can read? What does he read? Comic books?
Would you believe Dickens?"
Higgins stared at him. "You're joking."
"Square business," Connor said. "One of the security guards at the building takes night classes at the university and has a thing for classics. Said I saw him reading a book one time while he was out on break and asked him what it was about. Guy told him about it. It was Tale of Two Cities. Ice asked if he could borrow it when he was through. The man saw no harm, so he said sure. Ice has been borrowing books from him ever since. Dickens, Walter Scott, Robert Louis Stevenson."
"No kidding. Who would have thought it?" said Higgins. "There must be more to that gorilla than meets the eye."
Boy, oh boy. All right. "I've been thinking we could slip a mild sedative into his food," said Connors. Then we give him a shot and ring him out. He wouldn't even know it. It would give us some background on him.
No, said Higgins. I don't think there's any real need for that. At least, not yet. So long as he behaves himself and does what he's told, I really don't care who the hell he is. He's not that important. He shrugged. What would we find out? That he was born in the ghetto, learned how to survive on the streets, started running with the gangs and working out till he got as big as a house and took over the Skulls? There's nothing there of any interest.
We could find out everything he knows about the gang's operations, Connors said.
Who cares, said Higgins. The gangs are no interest to me. Let the police worry about them. I'm concerned with Borodini. He's the only one who's really powerful enough to pose a threat. With Borodini gone, the gangs will fall back to fighting amongst themselves again. My objective is for Steele to prove his worth by taking care of Borodini. Once he's done with that, the committee will be falling all over themselves to get us the funding that we need.
What if he fails? Said Connors.
He won't fail, said Higgins. He smiled. He's programmed not to.
Dev Cooper looked in a mirror. He looked terrible. He looked like he hadn't slept in days. He also looked hungover, and he felt it too. After Gates left, he had tried to get some sleep, but it simply wouldn't come. His mind kept clicking over, like a computer, he thought. He couldn't turn it off, so he decided to get drunk. For a man with his capacity for alcohol, that took some doing, but he managed. Eventually, he had passed out. He woke up at 10 in the morning, his head bursting. He had called in sick. It really made no difference. In his position, he didn't have to punch a time clock. His hours were his own to designate. But he had called in just the same to let them know he wasn't feeling well and wouldn't be coming in, and to tell them he could be reached at home. He felt exhausted. He felt like going back to bed and waiting until the hammering in his head went away. He opened up the medicine cabinet and took out the small bottle of pills he had prescribed for himself. Uppers. He took a few out of his hand and stared at them. Not a wise thing to do to take them on a hangover, with the alcohol still in the system. Not a wise thing to take them at all. He took them anyway, washing them down with water. He knew that he should probably eat something, but he couldn't stand the thought of food. He got into the shower and ran the water cold as he could stand it, and simply stood there, gasping and shivering as the water beat down on his body. He tried to will the headache away. He got out after a few minutes and dried himself off, then threw on his terry bathrobe and made a fresh pot of black coffee. He reached for the package of cigarettes on the kitchen table, took one out, and lit it. Booze, pills, coffee, and cigarettes. Keep it up, Dev, he thought to himself. Reach for every crutch that you can find. You're turning into a real maniac. You wish you had a therapist that you could talk to. Typical psychiatric daisy chain. Patient comes to a psychiatrist and unloads problems. Psychiatrist visits his psychiatrist to unload some of the stress and anxiety that the patient unloaded on him. That psychiatrist goes and sees his own psychiatrist, and so on down the line. One grand and an endless game of broken sequences of telephones. I'm fucked up. Pass it on. Only Dev had no psychiatrist he could go and talk to, because he couldn't talk about this case. It was all highly classified. Well, he'd already shot that all to hell by bringing home the program. But even if he went to see another therapist, he didn't know what the hell he'd say.
Doctor, I made a copy of a man, and I've got him trapped inside my personal computer. He thinks he's under mild sedation. Actually, it's since he's got an electronic brain, he thinks he's on downtime. But I don't know how long I can keep this up. He's starting to ask a lot of questions. I don't know what to tell him.
Very interesting. And how long have you felt this way?
Dev grimaced as he inhaled deeply and coughed. He wasn't used to smoking cigarettes, but he was getting accustomed to them fast. His eyes focused on the black liquid percolating in the coffee maker. Plop, 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 like a heartbeat. He didn't even wait for the coffee maker to finish percolating. As soon as the liquid looked dark enough, he poured himself a steaming cup. It was a rotten thing he'd done to Philip Gates. You couldn't forget the look in the man's eyes, the way his face fell when he told him.
You'd really do that?
And Dev hating himself, saying,
Try me. You son of a bitch! I thought you were my friend!
You son of a bitch. Said completely without bitterness or rancor. Stated flatly, like a fact. Yes, indeed, thought Dev. It was a fact. But then the other part. I thought you were my friend. The disappointment laced into that phrase. Disappointment that Dev, being who and what he was, had recognized instantly. The disappointment of a man who wasn't used to having friends. Who perhaps did not have any real friends at all. Only acquaintances and co-workers. The disappointment of a man who, deep down inside, did not expect to have any friends, and was in fact
prepared to be let down because it had happened to him so many times before. Disappointment that could probably be traced all the way back to his childhood, when he had been fat, awkward, and ungainly. Dev could see the boy as he called to his mind the image of Philip Gates, the man. A clever boy, clever and highly intelligent, shy, socially awkward, his mind already enthralled with concepts his peers couldn't even begin to grasp. The boy who had forever been the outsider and the reject, an object of fun and perhaps torment, seeking refuge in the stimulation of his superior brain and gratification in food. It had been that boy who'd spoken to him. It had been his expression Dev had seen, the gruff facade of the sullen cybernetics engineer stripped away to reveal the insecure little boy within, the inner child that no one really ever loses.
"Damn it!" Dev said. "Damn it!" He threw the coffee cup against the wall and it shattered into sharp ceramic shards, splintering black coffee everywhere. It didn't make him feel any better. But it was probably a healthy thing to do, thought Dev Riley. Don't repress it. Let it out. Okay, it's out. Now what? Shit! Compulsively, he picked up a sponge from the kitchen sink and started wiping up the mess. After he had picked up all the pieces of the shattered coffee cup, certain he had missed some, and he'd find them when he walked on them barefoot, he had another cup of coffee and sat down at the kitchen table to drink it and smoke another cigarette. He looked through the doorway of the kitchen and into the other room, where the computer sat atop his desk like a malignant electronic dwarf, its screen staring at him like a blind eye, not seeing him, but knowing he was there. He swallowed hard and took a deep breath, trying to steady his nerves. It didn't work. He could feel the uppers starting to kick in, and he knew there was no going back to bed, no sitting there and feeling sorry for himself, no wallowing in guilt over his rotten treatment of Philip Gates, nothing for it but to go to confront the specter or expend the drug-induced energy in something utterly pointless, like a cleaning frenzy. The apartment could use a thorough cleaning. But no, he pushed that tempting thought aside. Even without the headache, which he was either starting to get used to, or the uppers were making less noticeable, or else, in his current masochistic mood, he was starting to actually like it, it wouldn't work. That was a sentence. No matter where he went in the apartment, that computer's blind CRT eye would follow him everywhere, reminding him of the Steel program lying there dormant with its unanswered questions. There was no avoiding it. This is why he was here. Why he had traveled halfway across the country to New York to accept an opportunity most people in his field would have killed for and which still fascinated him like nothing he'd ever done before, despite the fact that it was driving him to drink and drugs, despite the fact that it was starting to really scare him. He went over to the computer and turned it on, inhaled deeply, exhaled heavily, bit his lower lip, lit it up yet another cigarette with a trembling hand and booted up the program. "Stale?" Steele's voice, or an electronic facsimile of it, issued from the voice synthesizer peripheral.
"Hey, you, Dev!"
Yes, it's May. How do you feel?"
"I don't."
The voice sounded edgy.
"You don't?"
Slow in the uptake. The moment he said it, he realized what Steele, what the program meant.
"I don't feel anything. I can't feel my body. I can't see. I can't move my arms or legs. I don't even feel like I'm breathing."
"That's perfectly normal," Dev lied. "It's like I explained to you before. You're not really fully conscious. Your bodily functions are slowed down on downtime, and you're not really aware of—"
"Why are you lying to me, Dev?"
Dev hesitated, taken aback by the response.
"Why would I lie to you?"
"I don't know. I can hear it in your voice. You're under a lot of stress."
Right, thought Dev. It's computer programmed with human and mental engrams. A cop's mental engrams. A cop's instincts. And a computer's ability to analyze vocal response patterns and identify a lie. Hadn't thought of that. Stupid. Stupid.
"I haven't been sleeping well lately," Dev said, hoping it would pass because it was the truth. He hadn't been. "And I got drunk last night, and I'm hungover, and I took some pills."
He stopped himself, aware that he was sounding manic.
Fucking pills. He shouldn't have taken them.
"Why can't I see, Dev? Why can't I open my eyes? Why can't I move? Why can't I feel anything?"
"I already told you."
"Tell me the truth, Dev."
"I'm telling you the truth."
"You're lying to me. If I'm on downtime, how come I can speak in here without any problems? I can't do anything else. How come I don't remember going on downtime?"
I don't know," Dev said, chewing on his lower lip. "I really don't know why you can't remember, Steele. But it's okay. There's nothing wrong. We've simply found a way. That is, Dr. Gates found a way to allow me to talk to you while you're on downtime so that I
can—" "Stop lying, Dev. Stop it. I can tell that you're lying. I can hear it in your voice. I'm not on downtime, am I?"
Dev hesitated.
"Am I?"
Christ, he thought. Turn it off. Turn it off.
"What have you done to me, Dev? Tell me."
Dev closed his eyes. He tried to think. You were injured. We had to effect repairs. We've come to had some of your senses disconnected so that... No, it wouldn't work. He'd know.
What happened to me, Dev? What's happened to my body?
Jesus!
Answer me, Dev!
Dev thought frantically. I can't lie to him anymore. He's learned to analyze my vocal responses like a fucking lie detector. What do I say? What the hell do I say?
Where's my body, Dev? What have you done with it?
Dev quit the program and shut down the computer. He sat there, his hands trembling, his heart racing. He leaned his head back against the chair and closed his eyes. God help me, he thought. What have I done? End of chapter.